This is W.W. Chaplin in the NBC newsroom in New York. In case you are of those who believe that no news can compare with the World Series, the Chicago Cubs won 3-0 today, making it 2-1 in their favor. Next game will be in Chicago tomorrow. The Detroit Tigers still have a fighting chance. Next to baseball, at any rate, the biggest news of the day is about strikes, because there is some brightening of the dark industrial skies. The government seized strike-bound properties of 26 oil companies in 15 states, turning over operation to the Navy, and union reaction was speedy. 43,000 oil men were ordered back to work. Chairman O.A. Knight of the CIO Oil Union's Executive Committee announced that he had wired all union leaders to give the Navy their pledge of immediate work resumption under government direction. He said they still technically are at strike against the companies, but they'll go back to work for the government. In Detroit, the Kelsey Hayes Wheel Company strike was announced by the CIO to be virtually ended. That was a principal trouble spot in the automotive capital, where some 80,000 workers are off the job. And in Trenton and North New Jersey, a 13-day bread famine ended when bakeries settled their differences as a result of federal conciliation. That's the bright side of the picture. There is still another side, and on that side there was violence today as well as idleness. Several men were beaten, one stabbed, automobiles were overturned, all in riotous blockade of Warner Brothers' movie studio in Burbank, California. Pickets barricaded a main highway passing the studio and detoured traffic. Several thousand movie set designers and decorators have been on strike at Warner's for more than 8 months, and they finally decided that their only way to act and get action was by direct action. And then, of course, there's the telephone stoppage that must have affected many of you this afternoon. Almost certainly, if you tried to make any long-distance calls or were hoping to get one. It started ahead of time in New York with Western Electric employees and quickly spread to Washington's long-distance operators, later becoming pretty general straight across the country. This stoppage was not a strike, but a sort of demonstration to indicate what would happen if the operators do decide to strike. They were voting on that during today's stoppage. There are interesting dispatches today from Berlin telling about discovery of a countrywide trend of German youth to enroll in underground warfare against our occupation forces. Resistance clubs, as they're called, are reported scattered from the North Sea to the Bavarian mountains. You were a day ahead on that news. What is in the papers today, you will remember that you were told personally yesterday by NBC's Roy Porter, talking to you direct on this program from Wiesbaden. And today I have another report from abroad for you, this time from the Pacific. You know that today the Japanese cabinet quit, and the emperor is now going to consult General MacArthur's wishes in picking a new premier to select another cabinet. We call in now NBC in Tokyo.
This is Guthrie Johnson speaking from Tokyo. Day before yesterday, I got back to Tokyo from a two-week air tour of Southeast Asia. I hit Okinawa, Hong Kong, Rangoon, and Bangkok, that city of temples where thousands of people worship before the Emerald Buddha, to Saigon, that strange mixture of slant-eyed Orient and Paris gowns. And then out of that jade atmosphere, back to Cokes and Donuts with the American Army in Manila. For most Americans before the war, that part of the world was Chapter 26 in the 8th grade geography book and nothing more. But today, it's extremely important for us. The reason? Well, I'd rather let three American observers who went with me tell you why. They are the three fellows who flew me there. Veterans of the 8th Air Force in Europe, they have flown their B-17 headliner over most of the world. They are the fellows who will be flying American commercial planes here after the war. First, here's Captain Mark Magnan of Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. Pilot of the headliner, who's the only man I know who can set a B-17 down on a billiard table with 2 feet to spare at the end. Mark, what about that landing in Saigon when we blew out a tire in the midst of a tropical cloudburst?
Well, Dan, your passenger didn't know it, but I couldn't see 2 feet in front of me there for a while. It's just another example, though, of what we hit all along the trip. Short fields and bad repair, nothing to guide you in. In other words, just a car crusher with tires.
Yeah, tar on it is right. And then a revolution to top it off.
Right. Believe me, after walking on flak over Germany, I didn't much appreciate getting shot at by the natives and being protected by Japs of all people. In a fight to kick the French out of Indochina.
I didn't like getting shot at either, Mark. But most people say that we haven't got anything to do with that fight.
The heck we haven't. Didn't you see those American land lease cars that the British were using? We were in a fight, all right, and providing the weapons. And don't people forget, Jan, that hundreds of American airmen fought over these areas, got shot down and died, or rotted in prison camps because we had to defend these areas.
Right, Mark, we did die defending them. It's something that few Americans realize. But what we do affects what happens in Indochina, and what happens there affects us.
Hold it, Jan. That's politics, and it's too deep for me. As an airman, I'm interested in the airlines we're going to run after the war.
You're right, Mark. We are going to run airlines through there after the war. But that's up Craig's alley. Lieutenant Bob Craig of Kansas City, our navigator, had this to run out some tough stretches. Bob, do you think it's going to be easy to set up our airlines?
Jan, did you say easy? I'd like you to come up in the nose with me sometime and try to plot a course across thousands of miles of mountains and water with inaccurate charts, no radio beacons, poor weather information, clouds hiding the sun and stars, and no ground radar. Just look at the gray hairs I've got at the age of 21.
You don't look too bad, Bob. But thanks, I hope just stay and be a passenger. Now, here's Lieutenant Charles Wisdom of Pittsburgh, Kansas, who's been flying co-pilot and can land a B-17 like you lay down a baby. Wiz, how would you feel about flying commercial airlines out here?
Well, fellas, I think you're forgetting one thing. We did get in those places, and we did get back here safely. Our American planes have equipment that can fly passengers safely to almost any spot in the world. Better airfields will make landing safer, and my bet is we'll have them out here soon.
And what makes you think so, Wiz?
Jan, we've flown over a good bit of the world. Europe, Asia, and the Pacific, and almost everywhere we went, there was an Army Air Transport Command station. And you know, and I know, why they're there.
Yes, Wes, we found them in remote spots where there was practically no Army business at all. One thing is clear, they are holding bases for our commercial airlines of the future. But you fellas are going home soon. Are you still game to come out and fly here again?
Sure, why not?
Could be.
I'm ready for any place, Jan.
Thank you, fellas. This is Guthrie Johnson speaking from Tokyo and returning you now to the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is W.W. Chaplin in New York again. In France, they put that Pierre Laval treason trial back together again today, but it hasn't made much progress. When it opened yesterday, Laval's lawyers walked out of court because they said they hadn't been able to prepare the defense properly. And then Laval himself was thrown out for getting too noisy with the judge. Everybody apparently recaptured their tempers during the night. The defense lawyers came back this morning, and the judge gave Laval another chance to be decorous. Today's business was concerned largely with a defense plea for postponement, which was denied. It ought to really get started tomorrow, and Laval has promised some startling revelations. In Washington, this was a big day for cheering heroes of high and low degree. All high in courage, but some low in rank for all that. At the top of the rank listing was Admiral Chester Nimitz, who visited Congress, who was given a parade, and who made several talks. He said that on VJ Day, the Japs had more planes and a bigger army than they'd had at Pearl Harbor time. But they were beaten, he said. They were all through even before the Russians and the atom bombs entered the picture, because both their fighting and their merchant navies had been destroyed. The men of lesser rank to be honored today were 11 Marines and 3 sailors, all of whom received the Medal of Honor, the highest valor award this country has. If you see anyone wearing a light blue ribbon with a few white stars on it, that's the Medal of Honor. It isn't showy, but it means more than all the rest put together. In fact, when Mr. Truman pinned the medals on these men today, he told each one that he would rather have the Medal of Honor than be President of the United States. Another news item from Washington will come as a surprise, I think, to many, to all who have a fixed idea that all management wants lowest possible wages for their labor. Patrick McDonough of Oakland, California, who owns a steel plant out there, he told a Senate Labor Subcommittee that an hourly wage of 65 cents is a pittance. It's not American to pay as little as that nowadays, he said. The subcommittee is considering a bill to establish a 65 cents an hour minimum for interstate commerce workers, beginning right now, and then boost that to 75 cents in 2 years. The minimum is now, of course, 40 cents for that type of worker. Mr. McDonough told the senators that high wages mean high production. The two things, he said, are synonymous, just as a well-kept machine is more productive than a run-down machine. They asked him then if a 65 cents an hour minimum might not necessitate higher prices for finished goods. I don't expect, he said, that it would affect prices one iota. That's just one man's opinion, of course, but it has added interest coming from the ownership side of industry. In the diplomatic field, the wrangle still goes on as to who was to blame for failure of the recent London Foreign Ministers' Conference to achieve anything particular. The Moscow newspaper Izvestia, which represents the Soviet Foreign Office, says today that the Russian delegation suggested extending the session in London one more day to make a last final try to find a wise compromise. But it says our Secretary of State Burns, for some reason, categorically refused. The Russian paper says that if Mr. Burns and British Foreign Minister Bevin, if the Western Allies, persist in their present stand, they say it will shake the very basis of collaboration among the three powers. Now, just what is all this rumpus about? Well, it's about the way to draw up final peace treaties with Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, and Finland. And the blueprint for that is the Potsdam Agreement. The whole business is just a difference in interpreting that agreement. The Russians don't want France to have anything at all to do with these treaties. They say that the Potsdam Agreement set it that way. Well, we and the British say that the Potsdam Agreement leaves it perfectly wide open for the French to discuss the treaties, discuss it with us at a general meeting, but not to vote on them. The important thing would seem to be the voting, and that the more minds enter the preliminary discussion, why, the better for everyone. But Russia doesn't see it that way and is being very firm about it. Mr. Truman did very well at Potsdam in getting the Russians to see things our way for a change, or at least coming to what Izvestia calls a wise compromise. Perhaps he will settle this one himself. There's a home tragedy to report. A National Airlines plane overshot the airport at Lakeland, Florida, today and dived into Lake Parker. 13 persons, including the pilot and co-pilot, were rescued. But a man tentatively identified as Florida State Senator Harrison Barringer was killed, and Mrs. E. Owen of Pineville, Louisiana, is still reported missing. It is to be hoped that this accident, bad as it was, will not shake anyone's faith in air travel. Wherever there is motion, on land, sea, or sky, there is always danger of accident. But it is worthy of notice that these were the first National Airlines fatalities since the line started operations 11 years ago. A little item from Tokyo today gives a good idea as to how thoroughly that country was militarized before we moved in. So thoroughly that even children were trained for war. The Japanese Ministry of Education, which has no minister, of course, since the whole cabinet quit today, but which is still running under MacArthur orders, that ministry abolished bayonet drills, target practice, ground battle technique, and military ski training in all Japanese schools. And they've got to go even farther than that to clear the warlike spirit from school gymnasiums and playgrounds. There's another order coming up that will forbid school courses in fencing and even jiu-jitsu. And that's all the news for now.
You have been listening to a commentary on the news by W.W. Chaplin from the NBC Newsroom in New York. This is the National Broadcasting Company.